Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Top kill in the Gulf of Mexico this week, the president knee-deep in oil spill drama, and the House votes to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yesterday, at his first press conference in 10 months, President Obama said it's his job to marshal forces to stop the Gulf oil spill disaster.
In case you're wondering who's responsible, I take responsibility. It is my job to make sure that everything is done to shut this down.
Louisiana James Carville told CNN the president needed to crack the whip harder on oil giant BP.
BP is not the equal of the United States government. And this president needs to tell BP, I'm your daddy, I'm in charge, you're going to do what we say. You're a multinational company that is greedy and you may be guilty of criminal activity.
And the House votes 234 to 194 to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Georgia Congressman John Lewis called for an end to discrimination against gays in the military.
It is an affront to human dignity and to the dignity and the worth of every man and woman serving in our military.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your verdict on the oil catastrophe? Is it still too soon to say? What's your top story this week? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Washington is Doyle McManus, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Doyle, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be back, Tom.
Also with us from London is Gillian Tett. She's U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. It's great to have you, Gillian.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Doyle, and Gillian.
This is no doubt going to be changing all day long, depending when you hear us, but here's the latest from Thad Allen. This is the Coast Guard Admiral in charge of the effort in the Gulf of Mexico on ABC's Good Morning America, saying the top kill effort had stopped the flow of oil, but it's too soon to celebrate.
They have been able to stop the hydrocarbons from coming up the well bore. I think the real challenge today is going to be to sustain the mud on top of the hydrocarbons and reduce the pressure to the point where they could actually put a cement plug in. And I think it would be very critical in the next 12 to 18 hours. And, of course, everybody's watching it very closely.
Plug not in yet, but there's the top guy, Doyle, saying that, you know, they've stopped the hydrocarbons from coming up the well bore. I don't know what to make of this at this point, Doyle. We've been told so many things so many times, and it's BP's equipment down there monitoring. What do you say to this latest news?
Well, Tom, one of the things we're all learning is a lot more about underwater oil engineering than we ever expected to know. And it turns out that these enormous, heavy pieces of machinery are actually quite delicate when you're applying enormous amounts of pressure from oil coming up below, mud coming down from below and above, and of course the sea pressing in. And the danger and the reason this is taking so long, Admiral Allen has told reporters here in Washington and down on the coast, is that if you push it too hard, if you don't do it exactly right, you could create a new rupture. You could make the problem even worse. So it is going to be some time before we know whether this fix has actually worked.
Jack, of course, there was the top kill, pushing the drilling mud down in there, and then along with that cocktail, I guess, the so-called junk shot that we've heard about for a long time now of, you know, golf balls and junk sort of put in there with it along to stop it. Are you resting easier yet, Jack, or not?
I'm not, and I'm especially not because of the what we found out from the Inspector General's report about how the MMS has been running this these safety inspections. According to the Times this week, this was under the Bush administration. The relevant authorities in New Orleans or Lake Charles were essentially allowing the oil companies to write out in pencil their safety reports on the platforms, and then the MMS people would write over it in ink, essentially, you know, just rubber stamping what the self-report of the oil diggers. And it's that has been the regime that's been operating. And I think it gave special point to the president's mea culpa when he effectively said, I trusted this system, and he trusted it knowing, because we've had past reports about this sort of thing.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll exchange between this service and the oil industry, straight up.
Right, absolutely.
Jillian, we want to get your view from London there, sort of home BP turf, and of course there's the president, but the voice that kind of tore the covers off this week was James Carville, raging Cajun, who just sort of let it rip on what this whole saga has looked like. Here he is on Talk of the Nation yesterday, NPR.
It's more all being dumped into the Gulf than BP ever told us. They've lied at every juncture here, at every juncture. And what this government needs to do, what the federal government needs to do, is institute criminal proceedings against BP. There's a wonderful piece in Bloomberg. I've been calling this forever. And they need to make them put up massive amounts of money to avoid going to jail.
Gillian Tett in London, how do you think that perspective is going to go down with the BP hierarchy? You know, criminal charges and threatened prison time for the top dogs, unless they put up billions to fix this up.
This whole story is clearly an absolute unmitigated disaster for BP. And, I mean, the fact that the senior management of BP are still being very cautious even now in terms of declaring victory in capping the leak indicates just what a complete public relations nightmare they face. I mean, in reality, there's a lot about this story we still don't properly understand. It's still unclear what was the responsibility of BP versus its subcontractors, etc., etc. But one of the fascinating patterns that strikes me is the parallels between what's going on right now and what's been going on in the financial industry in the last few years. Because once again, we've got a very specialist little area of operations that's really only understood by a tiny handful of geeks and nerds that everyone was ignoring until recently. But it's got the potential to really affect all of us. I mean, blot the world, not quite in absolute terms, but really cause huge damage. And yet again, we've discovered that because the government, the regulators, have essentially given free rein to the nerds, the geeks, we're living with consequences that are very severe for society more widely, but also, once again, putting companies in a very, very embarrassing position, and potentially even in jail, though we don't know that yet.
We don't know. I was happy to see James Carville just let it rip here. I mean, I have a feeling that we've been subjected to a kind of weird camouflaging pantomime for weeks here on top of what's really going on. Don McManus, a lot of criticism at the White House. The president responding to that yesterday about how this has been handled. But from another angle, this looks like yet another cleanup from Bush-era coziness. The president said it himself. Coziness with big industry here. I mean, there's sex and drugs between oil industry and the minerals, mines and mineral management guys. And here we've got the Gulf of Mexico full of oil.
Well, that's right. And to go to Jillian's point, this is another example of the fruits of a long period of deregulation. And when you deregulate and deregulate and deregulate, and then when the industry captures the regulators, and in the case of the Minerals Management Service, is actually in bed with the regulators in the literal as well as the figurative way, it's gone out of control. The problem that Barack Obama has, the reason that James Carville went nuts on him, and the reason the analogy with George W. Bush's Hurricane Katrina is and was uncomfortably relevant, is that the president was slow to act, he was slow to assert authority, he was deferring, to BP. It was reminiscent of what of Obama's performance on financial regulation, where in many ways he deferred to the banks and the financial institutions to figure out a way to clean up the mess, with this important difference. Barack Obama has been in office now for 18 months, and it's quite proper to ask, and he finally did answer that question. Okay, you knew that the deregulation had gone too far. You came in saying you were going to clean up the Minerals Management Service and straighten out this relationship, and it didn't happen.
Here he is yesterday talking on just this front, addressing doubts about whether the federal government was taking full charge of the oil spill catastrophe.
The American people should know that from the moment this disaster began, the federal government has been in charge of the response effort. As far as I'm concerned, BP is responsible for this horrific disaster, and we will continue to take full advantage of the unique technology and expertise they have to help stop this leak. But make no mistake, BP is operating at our direction.
Okay, maybe. Well, now, but it looked like for a long while there, like the White House was saying, it's your problem, you fix it. I mean, Jack, this goes, as Doyle points out, it goes to regulation, where that stands. And in some ways, it goes to questions about the pace and speed and depth of the Obama turnover, the changing of the guard when he became president. A lot was left on the cooktop here, Jack.
It was, and we know now, of course, that this particular permit for this exploratory well was approved by his Interior Secretary, by MMS, last year in the spring, and we now know, of course, that in the fall the scientists sent a letter to Secretary Salazar saying, you know, this is dangerous. We have to go back and look at this, and nothing was done. The president alluded to that yesterday. I couldn't help feeling watching the president, that if he had said what he must believe, that, look, Americans, if he had said in February, instead of, yes, we're going to go ahead with these offshore leases, he had said, you know, this would yield us about 3 cents a gallon in the year 2030. That's what estimates are, that opening up leases as he wants to do would yield. And Americans, that's just not worth it. The risks are too great. We're not going to go ahead that way. That's just pandering. And imagine if he had said that then, this horrible thing had happened. It would have vindicated his judgment. Instead, this calls into question his judgment and his credulous acceptance of the Interior's representations to him about its safety.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. Top kill oil drama in the Gulf. The president takes on the spill. The House votes to repeal. Don't ask, don't tell. You can join us. Gillian Tett's with us from London with the Financial Times, U.S. Managing Editor. Doyle McManus is here with the L.A. Times. Jack Beattie. Here's the BP top dog, CEO Tony Hayward, speaking to CNN's John Roberts just this morning, upgrading his assessment of the environmental impact from the spill. Hayward speaks first.
This is clearly an environmental catastrophe. There is no two ways about it. And all I would say is that in terms of the estimates, the initial rate was a government estimate. These rates are a government estimate.
But you're upping your assessment now to environmental catastrophe.
It's clear. I mean, it is clear that we are dealing with a very significant environmental crisis and catastrophe.
Remember the words, it took a long time for us to hear them. Let's go to Lou, truck driver in Columbia, South Carolina. Lou, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What do you think, Lou?
I think we should just boycott BP. I buy 1,000 gallons of fuel a week, and I won't buy another drop of that. I think that they should, for the most part, be apologetic to the people and more sympathetic to the people and put everything and anybody out there that can help clean the mess that's keeping coming as well as try to maintain them people's lives they've destroyed. I'm angry, and I want to put a sign on the side of my truck. I've got a 53-foot tractor trailer paint on the side of there, boycott BP, America. Because that's what I've been doing since it started.
That's going to be a big billboard, and we'll look for it, Lou. And I'm glad for your call. Thank you very much. Also, let's go to one more. Christian, Westminster, Vermont. Christian, you're on the air.
Yeah. You know, I've never seen such incompetency by this government, and not only Obama, but even the Bush administration. The regulations by the government puts on these oil companies, they force these people out to sea. There's so many regulations that they can't do it on land, they can't do it in Alaska, they can't do it anywhere. And you know, for the President of the United States to say he accepts responsibility, that's such a farce. Do you remember when Janet Reno said she accepted responsibility for the killing all those people in Texas when the place burned down? You know, when you accept responsibility, there should be consequences. And I think there should be consequences with these corporate leaders. I don't care if they're put in jail like Carville says, which they should be. But maybe they should think about the Asian policy where they take them out and shoot them.
Well, we're getting a little hard there, Christian, but we hear the anger. I mean, gosh, consequences are going to be starting right there on the seafloor, right up to the coast, and who knows where they'll end. I mean, Gillian Tett, I'm really interested in how you listen to this. Lots of companies drill for oil offshore. I'm not sure Christian's got it exactly right there on what drives them offshore. A lot of leases on land that haven't been tapped in this country. But how do you look at American handling of this inherently risky oil extraction offshore? Is it really different from other countries? Is this country slipshod compared to what you do off the, you know, off of Great Britain or what Norway does?
Well, the thing that strikes me that I find fascinating right now is the level of anger amongst ordinary people. And we just had the last two callers illustrate that very powerfully. And frankly, a month ago, I didn't think it was possible to have anybody that would be more unpopular than the bankers in America. And hey, now we know that BP probably is in that category. And in a sense, what is happening right now is the great reckoning, if you like. You know, America's lived for years thinking they could have cheap credit without worrying about the consequences, which was a very unstable financial system. America's lived for years thinking it could have cheap petrol, cheap gas, without thinking about the consequences of where that actually came from. And in a sense, what's going on right now is one rude awakening, which has unleashed a lot of anger, and potentially could be very destabilizing politically going forward.
But could the same thing happen off your shores in the North Sea? Do you do it so much better in the UK?
Well, we have, on the one hand, we have more expensive gasoline to start with.
We're talking about drilling on the ocean floor where the oil is.
We do have that, and we have a system regulation in place. Some people would argue that it's rather tighter regulation. We haven't had quite the scale of environmental catastrophe, as they're saying, but we certainly have problems as well. I mean, the reality is that taking oil out of the seabed is fundamentally a risky proposition, and you only do it if you have countries addicted to cheap gas.
The president was saying yesterday, look, it wasn't my first choice. It wasn't me shouting drill, baby, drill. He said that pumping up oil, extraction, was to be only part of the solution he envisioned.
Extraction is more expensive, and it is going to be inherently more risky. And so that's part of the reason you never heard me say drill, baby, drill. Because we can't drill our way out of the problem. It may be part of the mix as a bridge to a transition to new technologies and new energy sources. But we should be pretty modest in understanding that the easily accessible oil has already been sucked up out of the ground.
The president trying to get real there yesterday, but it did look a little slow out of the blocks. Beth in Schenectady, New York. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi. I was going to say that in Canada, they have to build a relief well at the same time that they build one of these monstrosities. And we're going to get sued because this is going to go down to Central and South America, and we are the landlords for these leases. We are responsible. And that sounds like sounds very cold. I'm horrified by what's happening to the environment. But they have no right to put these rigs in without putting a backup in and doing all the safety plans, which we let them do. So we are responsible for what's going to be the biggest catastrophe ever. And it's time to investigate everybody. The president's dragging his feet. He should have a call out to NASA, to MIT, to everybody, and he's not doing it. So it's time to investigate all of the ties to the oil industry. I understand that BP is asking for a judge in Texas to oversee these hearings, who is on their payroll.
A corner's cut on the way in here, certainly. I don't know about on the way out. We'll be watching that. Beth, I appreciate your call. And let me get one more right here from Paula, Burlington, Massachusetts. Paula, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just have to say, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for the Obama administration. I feel like this is a national civics lesson in the role of government. The Obama administration came in and had to fix what's going on in the financial sector, the explosions in the coal mines, whether we've adequately overseen oil drilling. I don't think it's handled well, but I just think they had a huge amount on their plate after the last 8 years.
It was a lot to clean up, and there may be a civics lesson. I mean, Bobby Jindal, Jack, saying, why isn't the federal government down here doing more? But then we remember, what was it, after the president's State of the Union speech, or big speech last year, it was Bobby Jindal on the air representing the GOP saying, federal government's too big.
That's right. And Governor Jindal has been demanding that these berms, little sort of, you know, sand barriers be built, across from ahead of some of the islands down there to prevent the effluent from getting up into the marshes. And he's been going on about this. And Thad Allen, the Coast Guard commander, said, well, you know, we're looking into it, and they in fact have given now permission for some of this. But he says it takes 6 months. months to 9 months to build these things. You know, there's been a lot of posturing here, and I want to pick up on something Paula said. What the president could do nothing about the hole. The government doesn't have that capability. We're not in the hole plugging business at you know, 5,000 feet under the sea. That has to be done by the company. And then the other business around it, the booms and so on. He's put 20,000 people down there. There's been booms. There are miles of booms. Partly what's been gone wrong here is the therapeutic part of this. The president hasn't been seen to be leading. Whether the government has been leading or not, we don't know. I've been watching Admiral Allen. Listen, I'm completely impressed by that man. There's no spin to him at all. He's all efficiency, all business, all integrity, all the time.
Yeah, well, I don't know, Jack. How come he was so satisfied with this 5,000 barrels a day estimate that was so clearly undershooting for so long?
Well, that's you got me there, and it's true. And I think the administration actually liked that lowball estimate because, of course, they want to go ahead with more drilling. And the worse the spill, the harder that case is to make. So, yes, that has been a problem.
Dylan McManus, on the one hand, there's going to be the Hurricane Obama's Katrina charge here. On the other hand, so much of this is rooted in a philosophy that may go right back to those famous Dick Cheney meetings with the oil industry about how they were going to proceed, secret meetings. And, you know, plug pulled on regulation, trading sex and drugs at the very, you know, agency that was supposed to oversee this, and corners cut all over Doyle.
Well, that's right. Let me go back to what Paula said about this being, I think it was Paula who said this can be a civics lesson. The question going forward is, what civics lesson are we going to take from this? All year long, people have been saying, and the polls have been saying, that the American people want less government, that they think the federal government is incompetent and that they want a smaller government. Okay, now you have a disaster like this. We all look to the federal government to solve it. Even Bobby Jindal, a small government Republican, is saying, where's the federal government with all its equipment to bail my state out of this mess? Okay, so are we going to take the lesson from this that we need more and smarter regulation, or less regulation and less government? That's really the battle that's being fought between and among the politicians here. And President Obama tried to do something a little bit audacious yesterday. I'm not sure it's going to work. I happen to think it should. And that is, he tried to take this crisis and turn it into a talking point in favor of the energy bill that his Democratic allies are trying to move through the Senate. Now, that energy bill includes expanded offshore drilling. Why? Because that was an attempt to put together a nasty congressional compromise to bring in some Republican votes. So far, it isn't working. But that's going to be the test of whether this civics lesson comes out on one side or the other.
I don't know about more government or less government, but certainly you need at least competent on-the-job government, not swinging from the chandeliers with the oil industry and saying, never mind the details on safety. Let's go to Carl in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
See, according to a survivor that I seen interviews on TV, an operator damaged the seal, the main seal, you know, which is supposed to shut the well off there in case of an emergency.
Yep.
The way they found out, there was pieces of rubber coming up through with the oil, and the workers did show it to management, and management ignored it.
Yes, exactly. There was a lot of pushing. I mean, right up unto this explosion, sort of pushing the limits, never mind regulation. But as you say, Carl, even debate among people on the rig. We've got some tape of that from testimony this week, speaking to federal investigators on Wednesday. Here's Douglas Brown. He was chief mechanic on the Deepwater Horizon rig, said BP ignored suggestions by the managers there on how to slowly stop drilling on the rig, sort of wind it down. At a meeting just hours before the blowout, he said the BP company man there disregarded recommendations from the senior platform manager and drilling operators and wanted to do it all faster.
I recall a skirmish taking place between the company man, the OIM, and the tool pusher and driller concerning the events of the day. The driller was outlining what was going to be taking place, whereupon the company man stood up and said, no, we have some changes to that.
Some changes to that. We're going faster. I'm still very curious about whether we end up in the criminal charges place that James Carville is describing. Sam in Medford, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think there's another civics lessons here that I think it's easy to just dump this on the Bush administration that, you know, it's too much deregulation. But I'd like to step it back a little bit and say that there's a trend that started with the Reagan administration. And it was basically that that privatization and deregulation was a good thing. And the over idea was that what's good for big business is good for America. And I would suggest the takeaway from all this regarding the oil spill, the financial crisis, is what's good for big business and big profits is not necessarily good for people. And making profit is not a good way to organize a society.
Well, I mean, we did pretty well with it for a long, long time, though, Sam. I mean, let us pick it up here. I mean, Jillian, you're looking on from London. I mean, certainly, you can cut corners and get dirty and go way too far. On the other hand, we need the efficiencies, and right now, as the president says, we need the energy.
Absolutely. I mean, as somebody who, in my early part of my career, lived in the former Soviet Union and more recently have seen some of the sclerosis that can happen in the European countries as a result of the heavy hand of the state, I'm certainly not dazzled by the idea that a government cures everything. But we are really at a fascinating breakpoint right now as far as, you know, America's intellectual history is concerned, because you really do have a swelling chorus of people saying, well, you know, the government should step in and fix this oil crisis. And yet, you know, we've had several decades, you've just pointed out in your discussion, when everyone's been championing the cause of small government. And it raises quite an interesting question going forward, because one of the themes that is emerging from the Obama administration now is a call for more regulation, regulatory overhaul, whether in the healthcare sector, financial industry, and presumably now the energy sector. But the question one needs to ask is, does America have the regulatory structures and the regulators in place who can actually handle this onslaught of new laws and regulations? Because historically, regulators have not been incredibly well paid. They've not been celebrated and really recognized as in terms of having status. But if America is swinging back into a situation where it's starting to re-embrace regulation, the question is, who is actually going to regulate?
Well, I hope we can get away from kind of a dumb big or small argument and toward a competent. I mean, we didn't even have regulation here, not at the level that mattered in the end. But you're right, it's a big battle. Carlo in Union Springs, New York. Carlo, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks. I just want to, first of all, say I would like to see the president, a president, risk a second term. Has anybody heard the word conservation? We're at war. You know, during World War II, we were racing gasoline. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but whatever we're getting out of these wells is a tiny amount of, and it may drop the price of gas. It's political cover, basically, is what it is. And I'd also like to speak to the point about big government versus industry efficiency. Anytime you create a situation where someone's not going to be overlooked and they're not going to be responsible, they'll cheat if they want to, a certain person, whether he's in government or business. So the idea that one is better than the other is kind of an empty argument. I would just like to see regulation, conservation.
We're at war. Carlo, we got it. We're coming up on a break. But, Jack, I'm interested in that. You know, Carlos asks, he says he wants to see a president who will risk a second term, and you really wonder how this pressure cooker will begin to work on President Obama, who came in wanting to kind of thread it down the middle.
Yes, he did, and you can argue, and I think he has tried to thread it down the middle. Unfortunately, this crisis has hurt him. 53% rate him now poor or very poor in his handling of it, and 60% think the same about the government, which doesn't augur well for a rebirth of regulation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on Wednesday, NASA space shuttle Atlantis arrived back to Earth for the last time as the space shuttle is winding down. A mission control announcer marked the moment.
Space shuttle Atlantis now comes home to the Kennedy Space Center for the final time in 25 years, 32 flights, and more than 120 million miles traveled. The legacy of Atlantis now in the history books.
Once giant radio and TV personality Art Linkletter died Wednesday at his home in Los Angeles at 97. Here he is from his hit CBS show, Kids Say the Darndest Things.
What's your dad do for fun, Tim?
drinks beer and smokes cigars.
What does your mother do for fun?
She doesn't have any fun.
She doesn't have any fun. And on Tuesday in Jackson, Mississippi, a memorial service was held to honor the 11 men killed in the April 20th Deepwater Horizon offshore oil rig explosion.
Some glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away.
We're looking at the news of the week this hour with L.A. Times columnist Doyle McManus, with Gillian Tett, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Fort Myers, Florida, and Paul. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Ashcroft.
Yes, sir. Ashbrook, yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I say that every other time I say your name, and it's not your fault. I keep thinking of the former Attorney General. You must have a similar
Let's thing. Forget it right now. What's on your mind, Paul?
I called Senator Lemire, his office, yesterday, about don't ask, don't tell. It seems to me that that policy was a mistake, and repealing it is a mistake, too.
Why?
What we need, I think, is a clear statement from the brass, the President, the Congress, and all the brass in all the branches of the military, that there shall be no boasting about sexual exploits on a military base by homosexuals or heterosexuals, whether homosexuals are the majority in one unit or not. It shouldn't be anti-homosexual or anti-heterosexual. It should just be
no boasting about sexual exploits. That may be the least of it, or pretty tough in a crowd of young people and in a military setting. But we're glad for your call, Paul. I mean, Doyle, what about it? Here we are. First of all, what is it that pushed this thing right now? The Pentagon said it wanted to have, the better part of a year to kind of study this a little more, and yet we've got a vote in the House. Why?
Well, because the Obama administration and the Democratic Party made a pledge to some of their supporters, the gay community, mm-hmm. that they would move on this, number one. But number two, in a more important sense, there has been an enormous generational change within the military. And if you talk with military officers, and the change is roughly around the age of 50 or so, if you talk to anybody, not anybody, but if you talk to military officers and people serving in the military below the age of 50, they're okay with this. They want to move forward. They have been at war for 9 years. They know there are gay people in the foxhole with them. They're over it. And the argument from gay and lesbians in the military that this is forcing them to lie about who they are, it's forcing them to be dishonest, which flies in the face of the fundamental honor code of the military, that's an argument that resonates. And so you have Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. a Republican in favor of this change. You have Mike Mullen, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, a lifetime career naval officer in support of this change. The opposition is from an older generation. John McCain, who's leading some of the opposition here, tried to organize military officers against it, and he couldn't do it. He had to go to the retired officers because they were the group who was most angry.
Interesting. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi last night on the House floor talking about the importance of repealing. She said, don't ask, don't tell.
Today, by repealing the discriminatory don't ask, don't tell policy, we also honor the service and sacrifice of all who dedicated their lives to protecting the American people. We honor the values of our nation, and we close the door on fundamental unfairness.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Gillian Tett, how does this look from the U.K.? What's your policy there? How do you handle gays in the military? Is it even an issue?
Well, the dominant theme, not just in the U.K., but across Europe, is anti-discrimination. And so, you know, there is a strong anti-discrimination policy.
But is it a problem in practice, you know, in the foxhole, in military service or not?
For the most part, no. I mean, you know, we are also engaged in conflict in Afghanistan and, you know, with out in Iraq too. And, you know, absolutely, there are far, far more pressing issues. And the fact that, you know, America is tying itself up in knots potentially again on this doesn't necessarily do well to foster, you know, a modern positive image. I mean, I thought the point about McCain having to go to the retirees is absolutely valid because there has been a big generational change. there has been a big change of attitudes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it looks particularly baffling that people should be so worked up about this.
Let's go to Victor in Atlanta, Georgia. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just wanting to make the comment on Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Mm-hmm.
As I was mentioning to your assistant as we were waiting, you know, with all the things that the Obama administration has to deal with, cleaning up all the mess from the Bush administration, the finance reform, regulatory reform on the insurance and banking industry, healthcare reform, immigration reform, now this mess with BP and the oil spill in the Gulf, and perhaps regulation on the oil industry.
Yes, sir.
The wrong time, and our military situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating. This is definitely the wrong time to be dealing with something as innocuous as Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Innocuous. Victor, let us pick that up. That's very interesting. From Atlanta, let me hold that thought. Get one more here from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 63 years old, and I was in the Navy from 1970 to 1980, and I remember answering questions on the applications about whether you were homosexual or not. Frankly, I'd like to see this repealed. I'd like to see it be wide open. I don't think it should even be an issue. And as far as that other Paul that called a little bit earlier and said he doesn't want anybody bragging about sexual exploits, I would contend that he's never been in the service.
Yeah, it's hard to hold that down. On the other hand, you know, I mean, Jack, this will be something new for the country to get used to in the U.S. military, and yet the Democrats are pushing the timetable here, I guess, maybe with one eye on the midterms, saying if we're going to keep promises, we better keep them now.
Yes, before we lose some seats. I'm as struck with the evolution of public attitude. 75% of Americans now want this repealed. 75% of Americans don't agree on anything.
Yeah.
That is a remarkable social evolution. Some would call it social progress, social learning. People have recognized how unfair this is. 13,000 people, a full division of service people, have been discharged because of this. Over $1 billion has been spent sort of policing it. People have had, as Doyle said, to impeach themselves, to lie when they raise their hand to defend the country. And the country has recognized that. The society has changed. Amidst all this terrible news, I find that among the most heartening things in recent years. Months.
I want to move to this big national security strategy shift that sort of came out in bits and pieces this week from different sources. The president began talking about it at West Point last weekend. We heard John Brennan, the assistant to the president for Homeland Security, and of course Hillary Clinton. I think James Jones was talking about it this week as well. Doyle, what's the heart at the heart of this new security posture that the Obama administration is pushing here?
Well, Tom, you're quite right that it's been coming out in bits and pieces, and what this really is, in a sense, is pulling together all the different threads of the evolving Obama foreign policy into one place. When Obama came into office, there was a change that was obvious. He, number one, he had a timetable for getting out of Iraq, and number two, he wanted to move away from the unilateral tendency of the Bush administration to a much more multilateral tendency. Okay,
mm-hmm.
What this document does is it pulls out a couple of things that weren't quite so obvious, and I'll just mention two. The big one is domestic economic strength is at the core of making foreign policy work, that if the economy is not strong, if the deficit isn't brought under control, then nothing we're trying to do overseas can be sustained because we can't afford it. So he's talking about an era of limits and an era of financial limits, and there's an interesting for historians echo actually of Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican president. And the second thing he's doing is he's downgrading the war on terror a little bit. He's saying this isn't our only focus. We've got a lot of other things to do. And if we put that one front and center, as George W. Bush did understandably in 2001, and say, That's the whole ballgame. We have distorted American foreign policy.
Let's listen to a little bit of how this has been described this week. Here is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. This is yesterday at the Brookings Institution think tank in Washington. She talked about Obama's newly released national security strategy and the intended changes in this policy.
We have to balance and integrate all of the elements of our power, starting with the so-called 3 Ds, defense, diplomacy, and development, but also including our economic power, and the power of our example. We need to have strategic patience and persistence because indirect applications of power and influence take time.
Including our economic power. Of course, that's been in more question in the last year and a half than it had been in a while. There was somewhat pre-elaboration on Wednesday from John Brennan, who's their assistant for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. He was also talking in Washington about the new strategy and terrorism in particular.
Terrorists may try to bring death to our cities, but it is our choice to either uphold the rule of law or chip away at it. They may strike our communities, but it is our choice to either respond wisely and effectively or lash out in ways that inflame entire regions and stoke the fires of the violent extremism. That is our choice.
Gillian Tett in London, how do you think sort of first circle allies are going to be taking this new strategy on board? Is it welcome?
I think it's very welcome. I think it shows that America's moving towards a rather more flexible approach, and that absolutely is welcome in Europe.
Jack, and how about politically? Does this work? You know, George Bush beat a very different drum when he was in office.
He did. There's in that respect, there's a sentence that leaps out at me. America's greatness is not assured. Can't imagine Bush saying that. You know, the vision, the sort of geopolitical vision behind this, I think comes right out of a book by Paul Kennedy a generation ago called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And he showed how over time, great powers have faltered and fallen. When they have overstretched, when their military and foreign policy commitments exceed their domestic economic strength. And, you know, what a week for this to come out when we've just, I think this weekend, we will have spent $1 trillion on these two wars. And that's, of course, less the cost for veterans and health care in the future. But $1 trillion on Iraq and Afghanistan. And out comes this report saying that our foreign policy strength depends upon our economic foundations. And, you know, the parable of imperial overstretch, exceeding your economic resources with your foreign policy, couldn't be more, clearly exemplified.
Don McManus, let's look at spending on another front, if we may. House and Senate leaders scrambling around this week for something like another stimulus bill here, maybe $140 billion, looking at keeping teachers employed, looking at keeping unemployment benefits available. Is that happening? Has it happened? Is it coming?
It's been happening for the last several weeks, and it still hasn't happened because Democrats are divided. Democrats are trying to figure out whether their message should be keep stimulating the economy or stop spending money. And Nancy Pelosi is having a heck of a time in the House holding her majority together, and that mini-stimulus, as it's been called, has been whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. It appears that funding for police officers and teachers will largely be preserved, but other parts of it sort of keep getting sliced away by the day.
So not there yet on that front. And, Doyle, you've also been watching Republicans sort of trying to find their center of gravity on the other side of the special elections and primaries we just had, looking themselves toward the primaries this fall and trying to figure out how to harness the whole Tea Party energy.
That's right. The Republican congressional campaign folks are trying to figure out if they can redo what Newt Gingrich did back in 1994, and that is put together a message that says to the country as a whole, that runs a national campaign and says, here are the 10 things we're for. And back in 1994, that helped Newt Gingrich and his Republicans take back control of the House. The problem they have, of course, is that back in 94, Republicans hadn't had control for so long, they could blame Democrats for everything that had gone wrong. Now there is some shared responsibility on both sides, so it's a tougher hill to climb.
How about this new website that went up, America Speaking Out, Republicans looking there for public input on what their policy should be?
It's a bit of a stunt because it's really a chat room for anybody who wants to weigh in and propose an idea to the Republicans. And rather predictably, it's brought practical jokers out of the woods. It's brought crackpots out of it's not really bringing forward that program, that platform that is going to win for the Republicans, but it's kind of fun to go look at.
I mean, all kinds of posts there. End child labor laws. There's one here that Dana Milbach looked at. We coddle children too much. They need to spend their youth in the factories. Oh, boy. Ask the public what your policy should be on the website, and I guess you get what you deserve, Jack.
Yes, you do, and I think Rand Paul has been consulting some of that advice. He told a Russian broadcaster just I think yesterday that maybe we should repeal the 14th Amendment because it protects the children of immigrants. You know, if you're born here, well, let's just take away 14th Amendment protection for them. Mm. Not such a great idea, Rand.
Gillian Tett, the euro and Europe have been scaring the wits out of us over here for the last week and more now. Is that any closer to finding a bottom, finding solid ground, Gillian?
Well, if you're feeling scared right now, you know, quite rightly so, because what is going on right now in Europe is very scary. In some ways, this is Europe's version of the subprime crisis. And, I mean, the good news is that they have managed to stabilize the situation a bit in the last couple of days. The bad news is that an awful lot of it is about sweeping problems under the carpet rather than dealing with them head on. I mean, you know, sounds rather familiar, doesn't it? And we're certainly not out of the woods yet as far as the financial markets are concerned, either in Europe or, dare I say it, America either.
Sounds terrifyingly familiar, and we will be watching closely. Of course, Wall Street's watching closely, and everybody with their 401ks, if they've still got them, watching closely. I guess we have to wish Europe luck on that front. Gillian Tett for our own good. Gillian Tett with the Financial Times, U.S. Managing Editor, joining us today from London. Thank you so much for being with us, Gillian.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Doyle McManus at the L.A. Times. Great to have you, Doyle.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.